Hello, this is Augustus and Tony Corbett, and you're listening to the Marriage Minutes Podcast,
where we use biblical principles to enhance marriages and eliminate divorces. For the next 30 minutes, get ready for lots of laughing, learning, and loving.
Hello, and welcome to the Marriage Minutes Podcast with your host, Augustus and Tony Corbett. How are you, sweetheart?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, babe?
I am doing so very well. And I'm looking forward to this topic, actually. But before we do, so is life good or what?
Life is good. Life is good. I'm telling you, I have no complaints. I'm alive and well, you know, overcoming, still, I guess, navigating through this pandemic. But, you know, thank God we are here. Our family's doing well.
Yes, absolutely. So the pandemic has really affected everyone's life. I think Americans are saying later for the pandemic and we're getting back to life as normal, but the pandemic has a whole nother set of goals, right?
Definitely.
It wants to spread as much as possible. In fact, I read this morning that Washington, D.C., the politicians, there's a huge breakout. Nancy Pelosi, Senator
Warnock.
And others.
Yes. So it's still spreading, but thankfully they're having mild symptoms or they're asymptomatic. So the vaccines are working.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
So there's some good news along with, you know, the bad news.
So we want to have a conversation this morning about a topic that means a lot to both of us. You as a retired child protective services consultant for the state of Texas. You spent the last 25 or so years protecting children, and you have a master's degree in social work. And I have, over the past 15 years, have been a practicing attorney and have handled many divorces in many child custody cases. And what is painful to me in these cases where children are involved is how oftentimes the children get caught in the middle of the divorce, of the sparring parents and the adversarial attorneys, sometimes the distant judge, and there may be guardian ad litems and all kind of people involved in these child custody battles. But what seems to stand out so many times is the fact that the child is the missing person, because the child is the child or children. In that, and I say that because their voices oftentimes are not heard. Court doesn't even legally hear them until they become 12 or so years old. So if the parties are not focused on doing what's in the best interest of the children can get the short end of the stick. So I know this is something that you also, you know, have strong feelings about. So that's what we're going to talk about.
Yes. I totally agree with you, because not only are the attorneys, the judges, but also Child Protective Services.
Yeah, I forgot about Child Protective Services.
I mean, and that
you all
is,
are very much in this process.
Yes, and child welfare can be very intrusive, very invasive. And so that's a whole nother dynamic involved when there is, you know, a lot of animosity or animus going on between the parents. So, yes, I have seen many, many children.
And you've been in court many times, and your workers have been in court many times in these cases.
Yes. In fact, you all, the lawyers, would subpoena child welfare workers to come and testify in child custody issues.
Exactly.
Because the CPS workers would have interviewed the children, interviewed the parents, interviewed close relatives, you know, all household members. So it's very invasive, and the children, like you said, are the ones normally caught in the middle, and that is the name of this podcast, Children Caught in the Middle.
All right, so there's a lot to unpack. We can say that. And so it may take more than one conversation because we're not going to talk for 2 hours about this. You and I both have a lot to say, but we're going to try to keep it, 30 minutes or so. But there is a lot to unpack.
Definitely. Definitely. So we need to jump in it so that we can try to disseminate this information to help. You know, the mission of this Marriage Minutes podcast is to enhance marriages and eliminate divorces. But in the cases where divorces cannot be eliminated, we just want to remind the parents, please keep your children foremost in the front of your mind when you're going through the divorce proceeding.
Yes, that's true. So you're going to kind of come at this from more of the, I guess, sort of the psychological, sociological, social welfare, child welfare perspective. And I'm going to come at it from both a legal perspective and as a minister. You know, I'm also a preacher of the gospel. So I think we got a lot to contribute to this conversation if we can just unpack it and unfold it, you know, and not just throw a bunch of information right now, because we're full of a bunch of information about this topic.
Yes, if you all could see our table, we have articles, we have iPads out. I mean, there is so much information, but yeah, we're going to try to keep it where you all can digest it and then apply it to your lives.
Yes. At the end of it, we're going to give some takeaways, you know, some suggestions on ways to, if divorce is inevitable, on ways to help the children to sort of shield the children from the aftermath of divorce. So I want to say this from the beginning, and then if you would, could you read some of the statistics that we found on another law firm's website? I think this firm handles divorce, so they see it like we see it. I just want to say this, first and foremost. It is heartbreaking. It is heartbreaking sometimes to see warring parents, and it seems like the children are just completely not on their minds. And there are times where we remind our clients, this is about the kids. The judge is going to be bound by what's in the best interest of the child or children. And sometimes we tell them, and the stuff that you're focused on right now is not child focused. Now, we do that. Now, to be honest and to be, to balance this, more often than not, the parents believe that they are fighting for the children. Okay? So it's not like, you know, the child in their mind is being caught in the middle. In their minds, they need to protect their child from that other parent or from that spouse, you see. So in many of these cases, parents are doing what they do believe is in the best interest of their child or children by fighting the other parent or spouse.
And let me jump in and say, definitely, and anyone could give accolades to a parent who's fighting to protect and keep their child safe. Because we when I was in child welfare, definitely reports would come in because one parent would say the other parent has an alcohol problem or has a drug problem or has untreated mental health, mental illness. I mean, those are legitimate reasons.
That's right. Or abusive, or neglectful.
They are abusive. Exactly. Abusive, yeah. You know, physically abusing the child or being neglectful, leaving the child home alone.
Or exposing the child to other risks and harms.
Yeah. Exactly. And all of that will come under the definition of neglect. Most of the cases that CPS deal with would be.
So that's a very good spot right there for you to tell us what neglect is.
Okay.
What is neglect?
Neglect
and abuse.
Okay, I'm going to give you the definition of neglect, and because we live here in Texas, this is from the state of Texas. Now, all 50 states and territories of the U.S. have some definition of neglect.
Okay.
In the state of Texas, neglect includes leaving of a child in a situation where the child would be exposed to a substantial risk of physical or mental harm without arranging for necessary care for the child and the demonstration of an intent to not to return by a parent, guardian, or managing or possessory conservator of the child. Now, let me just say, I know that sounded, you the lawyer, that sounded real convoluted. But basically it's saying you can be neglectful towards a child by what you do to a child or what you don't do,
okay,
in order to protect the child. The following acts or omission by a person: placing a child in or failing to remove a child from a situation that a reasonable person would realize requires judgment or actions beyond the child's level of maturity.
Well, hold on before you go further, because okay. Let's tell everybody where we're finding this. This is section 261.001 of the Texas Family Code. And you're literally reading 261.001 subsection 4, 4A1 and so on.
And you can find this right online.
Right online.
And if you don't live in Texas and you live in another state, you can go right online and find your state's definition of neglect and abuse as well. But it's all going to be similar, right? Because it's also bedded in federal law. You know, federally laws and state laws all say it is a crime to neglect or abuse a child.
Yeah. Federal law doesn't get so much involved in the family dynamics too much. It's principally left to state law. But there are some what we call uniform code of this and that does offer some guidance. But for the most part, as you said, if folks are interested in knowing what neglect and abuse is in their state, go to their state law.
Right, exactly. And a lot of times, one of the misconceptions that's out here in the public is that when we use the word neglect, we think it's only relating to, oh, you're not feeding your child, or you're not clothing your child, or you're not giving your child proper shelter. No. That's why I'm just going to read this, and then I will give some examples of what neglect could be.
Okay.
Neglect also could be failing to seek obtain or follow through with medical care for a child with a failure resulting in or presenting a substantial risk of death, disfigurement, or bodily injury, or with the failure resulting in an observable and material impairment to the growth, development, or functioning of the child. Now, an example of that could be one parent could say, well, you know, we got divorced, and when the child goes home with his mom, the mom doesn't give the child his medication that he needs for XYZ. That will fall under neglect.
Okay. Now, you were reading subsection A when I interrupted you, and I don't think you finished it all.
Oh, okay. So back up here.
Yeah, placing a child in
or failing to remove a child from a situation that a reasonable person would realize requires judgment or actions beyond the child's level of maturity, physical condition, or mental abilities, and that result in bodily injury or a substantial risk of immediate harm to the child. Now, an example of that, you all, could be domestic violence. A lot of yelling, screaming, or throwing objects in the home between the two parents, but you have a young child, or a child of any age in the home because that child could get injured. Or you're asking that child to understand something beyond his mental capacity to understand. If he sees dad hitting mom or mom throwing a plate at dad, that's neglectful.
Okay. Now, you just, that's absolutely neglectful. And what you just said just brought up something that is just in the news right now, indirectly. And that is the Will Smith, Jada Pinkett Smith, and Chris Rock debacle, right? I'm tying it in because I read some of Will's book. And some of what caused Will to do what he did, I believe, is related to some of the neglect, as you just defined it, that Will experienced growing up in his home. So let me just play a little bit of this, and then we'll get back to your definition.
Okay.
Okay. And we're not going to get much into the Will Smith thing in this conversation. We will in the next episode, where we talk about the fact that the American Psychological Association has recently apologized for not only overlooking and neglecting how, you know, racism has affected Black Americans, but even contributed to it. And that's when we're going to spend time talking about that, again, within the context of marriage and so on. But now I just want to play this, and it goes exactly to what you're saying, okay? This is Will's book, the Audible version.
Chapter 1, Fear. I've always thought of myself as a coward. Most of my memories of my childhood involve me being afraid in some way. Afraid of other kids, afraid of being hurt or embarrassed, afraid of being seen as weak. But mostly, I was afraid of my father. When I was 9 years old, I watched my father punch my mother in the side of her head so hard that she collapsed. I saw her spit blood. That moment in that bedroom, probably more than any other moment in my life, has defined who I am today. Within everything that I've done since then, the awards and accolades, the spotlights and the attention, the characters and the laughs, there's been a subtle string of apologies to my mother for my inaction that day, for failing her in that moment, for failing to stand up to my father, for being a coward. What you've come to understand as Will Smith, the alien annihilating MC, the bigger than life movie star, is largely a construction, a carefully crafted and honed character designed to protect myself, to hide myself from the world, to hide the coward. My father was my hero. His name was Willard Carroll Smith, but we all called him Daddy-O. Daddy-O was born and raised in the rough and rugged streets of North Philadelphia in the 1940s. Daddy-O's father, my grandfather, owned a small fish market. He had to work from 4 a.m. until late at night every day. My grandmother was a nurse.
All right, so is that what you're talking about?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. Wow. Yeah. I mean, all I can say is, wow, my mouth is dropped.
Yeah.
This is exactly what I am talking about. He was in a neglectful situation.
Yes.
Witnessing his father punch his mom.
So the fact that the fact that Will's father didn't abuse Will, so that's not abuse, but it's still neglectful.
Exactly.
Now, let me ask you this though. Okay, and I kind of know the answer because I'm a lawyer, but let's talk it through. So in that situation, are you saying that CPS would say to Will's mother, you are neglectful of your son for having him in this abusive, in this physically abusive environment?
Okay, that is an excellent question, and that is one that is talked about a lot in child welfare, because domestic violence organizations that help and support victims of domestic violence would tell us, CPS, do not penalize that mom because she's a victim. Not only is Will a victim, but the mom is a victim. It's the father who perpetrated the violence against the mom. So in child welfare, the child welfare world, if the mom is being protective, if she's going to remove Will from, would have removed Will from that unsafe environment, then we would not be substantiating her for any neglect. It would be the father.
Okay.
And a lot of times those advocates for most of the victims of domestic violence are women. You know, there are some men, but the majority are women. They would definitely collaborate with CPS, with child welfare, and say, please do not re-victimize the mom by substantiating her and saying, validating that she also was neglectful.
Okay. So, all right. So let me go back and say, plan this does not, we're not planning this to somehow try to justify what Will did at the Oscars when he assaulted Chris. That's not why we played this at all.
No.
And we're going to talk about that, though, in the episode where we talk about the APA's apology to Black America. We played this because that environment that Will grew up in was an abusive environment and a neglectful environment.
Right.
All right. So you would not want to re-victimize the mom who was the victim herself as well as Will. But what about if she stayed in an environment like that, kept Will and his brother in that type of situation? At that point, does it become neglectful? And this is not to go at Will's mother, so let's forget about Will's mother.
Forget about
Will's
mother.
Let's talk about, you know, parents. Let's go back to our conversation. So parents who are in this situation, all right, the mom is being abused by the father, all right? Yet she stays in that situation. Is there at some point that Child Protective Services would say, okay, this has now become neglectful?
Definitely. Every day.
Talk about that.
Every day. Yes, because we would give the non-perpetrating and the non-offending parent the opportunity to protect the child and to provide a safe environment for the child. So we would be telling the mom, and we would talk to both parents, and we would tell dad, we're asking you to leave the home, you know, go find you some other place. You need to get help. You go to, you know, enroll in some anger management or batterers intervention program, something.
And most likely the father would have also been probably charged with something criminally, right?
Yes.
So there would be some court, some criminal court intervention and police officers and us lawyers.
Right.
And most likely that father would be, you know, required as a part of any plea negotiation or whatever happens to him, to take a battering class. Here we call it BIP.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Batters Intervention. What is it? Program. Mm-hmm.
Right.
There are two P's. So I forgot the last one. Batterers Intervention. I don't know. I can look it up,
but go ahead. But yeah, we would refer them to BIP. And a lot of times the reason that we know that this is going on is because of law enforcement. Remember, child welfare works very closely with law enforcement. So if law enforcement goes out, say a neighbor calls the police, or if mom calls the police because of some abuse going on, the police comes. And if the police sees that there are children in the home, they automatically will make a Child Protective Services report.
All right. It's Battering Intervention Prevention Program.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. So because law enforcement would contact CPS, because there was a child in the home, that's how we would get involved. So okay. Police already involved. Police would have arrested the offender or asked the offender to leave, whatever the situation would be. We would then get involved and ask the mom how you plan to protect your children.
Okay. And if she failed to do it, now, although she is the initial victim, she is now victimizing her child by keeping that child or children in that situation.
Right.
Yeah.
Or, and it plays out in so many different ways. It could be that, yes, she initially cooperates and says, I won't let him back in the home until he gets some help, you know, and I'll keep in contact with CPS. You all can come and make sure he's not here. Or sometimes we will find out where when the offending parent is released from jail, she lets him back in the home, you know. So, again, subjecting those children to an abusive father.
Well, there's probably going to be a protective order at that point. Okay. Here in Texas, when there's been some family violence like that, the magistrate typically will, in fact, is required to issue a protective order, keeping the you know, the abuser away from his victim for 60, sometimes up to 90 days.
Definitely. Yeah. All of that happens, but we are involved because of the protection of the children. They can have their protective order, as you know. That's just a piece of paper. We get a call. We, CPS, Child Welfare, would get a call from a grandmother, say, hey, my daughter has let this man back in the house. He's not supposed to be in the house. So we have to go back and, you know, address all of that. So you're right. The legal the legal system is trying its best to protect the child. But ultimately, that's why we have a Child Protective Services.
Well, you know, and the legal system is, and thank God for the Child Protective Services. I've always, over the years, have applauded the work that you all do protecting children. Now, Texas here recently has curtailed a lot of the authority that CPS has in protecting children. Okay, that's a whole nother ballgame.
Yes.
we got to get into that at some point, but I just wanted to throw that in. Every week CPS is in the news Texas CPS, DFPS is in the news every week because of its failures to protect children.
Right.
All right. So I see you here. I listen to you talk about CPS doing a great job. And the workers do, but the system can do a lot better. And those folks there in Austin could certainly do more in protecting children here in Texas.
Yes.
It's a whole nother ballgame.
Yes.
All right.
But I do want to bring out also, we use something, an extreme example.
Okay.
Neglectful situations between parents, you know, prior to the divorce, like pre-divorce, it doesn't have to be someone just punching someone.
Okay.
You know.
All right.
It can be just a chaotic environment, a bunch of yelling, a bunch of screaming, where the neighbor would call Child Protective Services and say, hey, that baby's over there crying, you know, it's a 6-month-old baby. And because they all night long, 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning, I hear them fussing. I don't hear any, you know, objects being thrown, but I hear them fussing. That's also a neglectful environment. And I want the audience to know that.
So children are caught in the middle in that type of situation.
Exactly.
As well. We haven't even necessarily, as you say, it's a great point, Tony, we haven't even gotten to court yet.
Right.
This is pre-divorce or pre-custody battle.
Right.
But the child is already caught in the middle of this mayhem.
Exactly. And that's why in the legal definition it says it's beyond the child's level of maturity. What does a 6-month-old know about, I'm just hearing a bunch of screaming and it's getting the child jittery and screaming and crying.
So can the child at 6 months old be traumatized?
Yes.
From a chaotic environment like that?
Definitely.
At 6 months old?
At 6 months old. Definitely. In fact, most, the neglect tends to really impact children younger, three and younger.
So the, okay, all right. So the impact is greatest for children 3 years and younger,
right,
when they're in that sort of chaotic environment.
Right, exactly. Yes. And that's what my specialty was.
Wow.
I was a consultant, and most of the cases I dealt with children who were ages three and younger because they're at their most vulnerable state at that age.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I know they're their most vulnerable state physically. But you're saying emotionally, yes, and mentally, psychologically?
All of that, definitely, yes.
And so the parents are thinking that their craziness is not impacting the child because the child is not old enough to even really know what's going on?
No, that's what I'm trying to say. Please, that's a myth. Your child still emotionally, psychologically is being impacted from the chaotic, the confusion, just the drama that's going on in your home. And most parents would not think that, because when workers would go out there and say, well, yeah, we got a neglect report. Neglect? I feed my child. You see, the child got formula. I got diapers. You know, I got clothes. What you mean neglect? It's the environment.
That abusive.
Right.
Environment. But the child, though, is in there on the bed. The child doesn't even know what's going on.
But the child's behavior, the child can become irritable. The child's...
What I'm asking you is, so let's say the parents are in there fighting and they do this all the time, okay? And sorry about that. And they do this all the time. And mom says, well, I'm putting the child in the other bedroom, so the child can't be here, or the child may be right there. But they're thinking the child is only 2 or 3 months old or 6 months old. They cannot understand what's going on or be impacted by it. You're telling us that is a myth.
Yes.
Emotionally, that child is hearing and feeling and processing at that child's level.
Right.
All that chaos.
Exactly. Now, it's good, and I would say this, if one of the parents put the child in a different room, that's good, because they're trying to bring some distance.
Trying to buffer it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying, if, you know, we've had situations where things just get so loud that it wakes the child up. And the child wakes.
Startle them in their sleep.
Right, exactly. And they start crying and screaming. Or if the parents are so into their drama, they can forget to feed the child. I mean, that's how all of this neglect can play out. They forget to feed the child because they are so mad. Or the mother gets up and leaves out the home and goes to grandmom's home, leaves the child there with the dad. The dad doesn't know anything about how to feed the child. That's neglectful. Or the child needs to be changed, but because they were so into their thing, the child is not being changed. All of that is how neglect, I know these convoluted words, but how it can just show up in a home and affect the child.
Well, what they can't see here is, because this is the audio, this is a podcast, is this is heartbreaking for me to even hear us talk about this. A child, you know, months old, waking up startled in his or her sleep because the parents are going at it like that. That may be surprising coming from a lawyer, because, you know, the perception is the lawyer is just there to get the money and just to fight, you know, for the parent and so forth. No, we are humans.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we are lawyers. We have ethical duties. We must zealously represent our clients, but we're also an attorney and counselor. So oftentimes we counsel our clients that this is not in the best interest of this child, this behavior right here.
Right.
I mean, this is not what we need to be doing. And let me go to the definition, because there are some nuances in what you read that lay people will not get. So I'm back in, again, 261.001, subsection 4A, small letter I. The leaving of a child in a situation where the child would be exposed to substantial risk or physical or mental harm without arranging for necessary care for the child, and the demonstration of an intent not to return by a parent, guardian, or managing or possessory conservator of the child. So leaving the child in a bad environment,
right,
is neglectful.
Leaving the child in a bad environment, or, and once we get into the divorce, what tends to happen is, because the two parents are not living under the same roof, mom works, mom needs babysitter.
So she leaves the child with the older child.
She leaves the child with an older child who's not old enough to babysit.
Right.
Or she leaves the child with a brother who has a drug problem, right, or she leaves the child with someone who has been a sex offender. All of that gets into neglect.
Yes. All right. The following acts are omissions, like you said, so not necessarily just acts, but even when you don't do things, omissions by a person. Placing a child in or failing to remove a child from a situation that, watch this, a reasonable person would realize requires judgment or actions beyond the child's level of maturity. I want to focus in for just a second here, and this is the lawyer part of me coming out, on the words reasonable person. Reasonable person. So that means basically, that's an objective standard and not a subjective standard, okay? So it doesn't matter if the parent says, well, I thought that it would be okay leaving the child at the home of my brother who she knows uses drugs or sells drugs or what have you. I didn't know because he doesn't do that anymore, blah, blah, blah. That's subjective justification. This statute says that a reasonable person, meaning not what you subjectively think, but what a reasonable person, what an objective person would think would be a safe environment. That's the standard that this particular statute holds people to, not one's subjective, personal standards, because that changes can change for everybody, right?
Exactly.
I mean, what mm-hmm. you think is a good environment may not be what I think is a good environment. So the law says it's based upon what a reasonable person, right, what a reasonable, objective person would think. So being in that type of environment, any type of neglectful environment, and there are many, we don't have time to go through all these, there are many such examples of what could be neglectful, is not based on what one thinks subjectively, but based on the reasonable person.
That's now, a very good point.
Yes. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you. It is to me. I don't know if I'm getting too lawyerly here, but these are the kinds of things that we would fight about if the matter hit court.
And this is what, on the child welfare, when we are trying to make decisions, remember, because child welfare has the authority to remove children from homes, and we would have to make assessments. That's what I did every day. I had to make assessments. Would a reasonable person do this, allow this, or think this, or leave a child in this situation? So that's why I'm glad you brought it out, because yeah, I had to think along those lines, you know, when I was in social work.
Okay. All right. I think let's stop here. It's been 40 minutes already. There's so much more to unpack. But I think this is a good place to stop, and we will do part two and go further into this.
Well, before we stop, I think maybe just read those statistics very quickly, and then we can end.
All right. Okay, you're going to read
You want, them? Okay. So these are some children and divorce statistics. 50% of all children in the United States will witness the end of a parent's marriage.
Yeah, let me read these because, having represented people in many divorces, I really can relate to this. 50% of all children, as you just said, in the U.S. will witness the end of a parent's divorce. How sad. And that's why this podcast is dedicated to eliminating divorce.
Right.
And we should say it the other way, enhancing marriages so we can eliminate divorces, right?
Okay.
An additional 50% of children who witness a parent's divorce will also see the breakup of a parent's second marriage.
Wow. Woo.
Isn't that something?
Yes.
So an additional 50% of children will see a second divorce. A daughter is nearly 5% more likely than a son to see a parent's divorce. Spouses with three daughters are 10% more likely to get a divorce than spouses with three sons. I have no idea why.
I don't either.
Children born out of wedlock are 24% more likely to see their parents divorce. Now that's kind of weird because if you're born out of wedlock, how can you get a divorce? What am I missing?
No, they're saying the children, say Mary has a child named Sam. When Sam and Mary was not, the mother was not married. When Sam grows up, let me see, children born out of wedlock, and then if mom marries someone, mom and that father,
all right,
stepfather could get a divorce.
Okay, 24% more likely.
Right.
All right, physical effects of divorce. Children of divorce are more likely to experience physical hardship, such as injury, asthma, headaches, speech impediments, than children whose parents remain married. Children of divorce are 50% more likely to develop health problems, emotional effects. Children of multiple divorces are considered less pleasant to be around. Teens in single parent and blended families are 300% more likely to need psychological help. And I'm telling you, I've seen this, Tony. I've seen this in my law practice, okay? And there's other stuff that we could read, but yes, those are some of the stats that caused us to even do this podcast, Children Caught in the Middle.
Yes.
And like I said, this is part one. We're probably going to do part two because there's so much to unpack. You pretty much laid out for us some of the CPS considerations. In our next broadcast, we'll come on into the court system. Because we dealt with things kind of pre-divorce. Now we're going to talk about things during the divorce and after divorce that can, again, catch children in the middle and be harmful to children.
Sounds good.
All right. Very good. Thank you for all that you just laid out for us. Your expertise on this topic is spot on. Spot on. Spot on. And you folks should be glad that she is... has this background and can really get into this issue. And so we enjoyed, it's painful to talk about it, but we enjoyed bringing it to you because we want to help you at the end of the day. We want to do what our mission is, enhance marriages and eliminate divorces.
Yes.
All right. So until the next time, this is Augustus and Tony Corbett, and you have been listening to Marriage Minutes Podcast.
Bye-bye.